Hello everyone, and welcome back to Let's Talk Assassin's Creed. This is episode 171, and this is going to be a good one. First of all, welcome back. I'm joined by my co-host Chris.
Hello everyone.
Good to have you back, mate. It's only been a few days since we last chatted with Leo and Hayate to talk about the gameplay of Mirage, and we are doing another Mirage-themed episode today, and we're joined by a very special guest, Maria Lewis. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here, and thanks so much for accepting a random invite from two podcasters on a pokey little Assassin's Creed podcast. We're really pleased to speak to you.
Well, I have to say thank you to you guys, because what the listeners don't know is that we rescheduled this interview twice because of my fault, because I had quite severe tonsillitis and pharyngitis and so literally couldn't talk. And huge thank you to you guys for being so flexible with getting messages from an Australian at weird times of the day and night, being like, I'm so sorry, but my throat's closed over. Can we postpone?
It's all good. We're hot tea. We are ready. Our voices are prepped.
Exactly. The worst part, to be honest, is not only was I banned from speaking on a liquids only diet, I wasn't allowed to have hot tea for 3 weeks, which, you know, made me want to kill myself. Why don't I?
Right. Well, glad you're better. Really glad we're all here. Let's just set the scene. So we're recording right at the end of November. It's been a couple of months since Mirage released. It's been about a year since we saw the first game trailer and we saw this new character, this mentor of the Brotherhood called Roshan. And I got to say, she left an immediate impact, I think, on everyone that saw that trailer. And Maria, you got to write the book that fills out so much of her backstory and her character that we see on screen. We have prepared many questions. Chris and I have both read the book. Thankfully, we got early access, which was great. So, Chris, do you want to get us started?
Yeah, no problem. So, first off, could you describe a little of your previous works before you started writing Daughter of No One? I think Daughter of No One is your 10th novel, is that right?
It's my 11th, but you're so close.
11th, so close. Okay. And how did it feel starting out on this project?
Well, it was really interesting. And also you saying it's my 10th instead of my 11th is like no big deal, because I had somebody congratulate me the other day on this being my debut novel. And I was like, no, babe, I have been around feels like 86 years sometimes. No.
So I wrote that question. I went onto your website. I had a look at all your previous novels. I thought I'd counted them correctly. I'm really sorry, but I'm glad I didn't mess it up and put debut novel.
No, honestly, like the difference between 10 and 11, who gives a shit? But so I have a previous novel series called the Supernatural Sisters series, which is 8 books, all bestsellers and award-winning books here in Australia. They're in the fantasy genre and they looked at mythological monsters with a feminist twist. So sort of looking at mixed race identity through the lens of werewolfism, being a woman trying to find your voice through the lens of banshees. So taking those classic sort of monsters that people knew from different mythological stories in different countries and giving them an upgrade and sort of like a modern lens and using different types of women to explore different types of stories. So female characters of different ages, different ethnicities, sexualities, backgrounds. That was sort of the prism through which I was exploring that. Then I had a Marvel novel with the character Mockingbird, Bobby Morse, who's an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., and a pop cultural slasher called The Graveyard Shift, which came out earlier this year, which is basically like Scream for Gen Z, if you will. But the Supernatural Sister series in particular was probably most relevant in terms of writing Daughter of No One, because each of those books played in different time periods. And even though all of the 8 novels are set within the same world, each one has a different main character. So there was an interplay and a world building that was actually a great prep for a book like this and for a world like this. And then I had done, obviously, the Marvel novel, but I had also done some work at DC Comics. And sort of understanding how to balance IP and how to balance characters that have a huge fan expectation but also have a lot of built-in canon is a very specific skill to learn and can be really quite tricky, actually, especially when you're used to sort of like writing your own world or playing in your own world. My main job is in the film and television space, and so a lot of the work you do there is scripting original characters or coming up with original characters in a group setting, because film and TV is a team sport. So it was sort of a perfect meshing of all of my interests and skill sets in one. And the way it was pitched to me, like the way that the project was first popped up, is I had worked on a previous project in-house at Ubisoft for 4 years, and it was a gaming project. And then I had also worked with the publisher on this Marvel book. So again, converging interests if you've just been kicking around long enough. And someone, my editor, actually, the amazing Gwendolyn Nix, who just has the most incredible name, pitched it to me as, "Hey, so you like history?" I was like, "I do love history. Like, where is this going?" And that was basically the slow roll into, we're looking at, doing a series of novels sort of set in and around a forthcoming Assassin's Creed game, Mirage. And the character of Shan, has been kicking around for a while, as most AC fans know. But having the opportunity to basically establish canon for a legacy character like this is so rare. Because part of her whole thing is like being mysterious, and you don't know much about her background. And they really had like three or four tentpole things that had to be in her backstory, and then the rest was just like, you give us some solutions and like pitch us some ideas, and we approve them or not approve them. But they gave me space to cook, which was very, very exciting.
It's awesome. I would love to ask about that 4 years of game project, but there's probably a big NDA slapped on top of
Yeah.
that. So yeah, we won't dive into that this time. You've kind of touched on this already. So you already had worked with Ubisoft. You had the right skill set. Did you need to pitch for the job, write a story treatment, or was it a case of, Maria, you've got the skills, you're in, let's go?
Oh my God, could you imagine? I don't think they'd ever risk it.
I should clarify, we are not literary experts. We have no idea how the industry works, but you know.
No, it's more just like for a brand this big and for something that has such beloved IP like this. No matter what it is, really. But in the case of the way the process of this worked, hey, do you like history? I love history. Cool. We were thinking of doing this idea. Could you pitch us a story? And so the way it works, and the way it worked with the Marvel novel as well, and the way it works for most of these IP properties, same in my work with DC as well, is that you usually pitch several options of stories, and there'll be a quite small synopsis, maybe 50 to 100 words on each, and you give them a few options. In the case of this book, I think I pitched five potential stories. Two get flagged, you expand on those two, and then one gets locked in as this is the one we like. And then it's a pretty lengthy process, honestly, of you expand each time. So by the time you're actually greenlit, approved, ready to go, you have gone through an expanded synopsis, detail. In film and TV, you would call it a treatment, really, which is basically like a prose version of what the script will be. And it's usually about 4,000 words in this case, and each plot beat needs to get approval from Ubisoft. In the case
Oh,
of
wow.
Marvel, it was each character that I used needed to get pre-approval that I was able to use them. So in Mockingbird Strikeout, which is my novel with them, Bobby Morse obviously is the main character, but I also wanted to have her work in this team called Team B, like the B team, but it stood for Team Babes rather than them being like the more shit version. And so that team was She-Hulk, Maria Hill, Tigra, right? Who aren't necessarily what they would consider tier A characters, but they are characters who have legacy and are important. So you have to get approval to use those characters in case somebody else is already using them. And even characters like Bobby Morse was married to Hawkeye, right? So like you've got to get approval to use Hawkeye. I have Daredevil as her divorce lawyer. Sorry, as Hawkeye's divorce lawyer, and Jen Walter, She-Hulk, is her. So stuff like that. Lance Hunter using Strike. And the same thing with Assassin's Creed. Obviously, because this was Rashaan's origin story and she doesn't get it's leading up to how she's first exposed to the Brotherhood, in this case called the Hidden Ones at the time. So there is minimal crossover, at least so so you think, in terms of pre-existing Assassin's Creed characters. There is some intentional Easter eggs that I put in there and things that overlap with other Assassin's Creed properties, and even stuff like that is you have to get approval from Ubisoft about whether it's okay to like wink to this thing, or maybe you've done 10 winks and they're like, which is, I think actually from memory, because it's been a minute, but I think I was like trying to shoehorn too many Easter eggs in there, because there's in particular, there's an Assassin's Creed manga that I really love that is quite close to this time period, even though it's a different geographical place. And so I was slipping in a few references to that. And they're like, listen, the two references you've got are probably enough. Could you maybe call it on the little acknowledgements, which I think is cute. But I just, you know, this is the fun of getting to play with somebody else's toys, is if you're creating the toy box, it takes a while before you've built up enough stuff and that your audience, whatever kind of audience they are, whether that's a viewing audience or reading audience, can recognize and acknowledge those connections. So Assassin's Creed being a legacy brand, those connections already exist and people already understand them and are hopefully excited to see them. And I think that's the beauty of Assassin's Creed, is it is such a intricate and interwoven tapestry of stories across time periods, across technology, across characters. So that was also, you know, one of the really exciting things for me about getting to play in the Assassin's Creed world, is little shout outs or little echoes to characters or moments from the games and the other extended media that you can, you know, just give a little hat tip to.
So that actually sounds like a lot of fun, being able to just think like, oh, what can I fit in here? What wee nods can I fit out of that? That's great.
Yeah, so it was, there was even a part where I was like, I had a minor villain, and I was like, you know what? This could just be like fucking henchman number 5. But is there someone in particular that you guys love who you haven't gotten to use? Or like, you know, everybody who works on a Ubisoft project, which is usually hundreds, oftentimes can be thousands of people.
Yeah.
They all have a favorite, and it's usually never your main character. And they all have a sneaky little person they want to see cameo. So just asking other people, like, you know, Who would you like to see in here? Because I can put them in. If you give me approval, I'll slip them in.
Good stuff. So before I read this next question, I'm just going to preface it by saying I'm going to butcher the name and I feel so bad about it. But you dedicated the book to, is it Shora Agdashlo?
Honestly, I think asking a Scottish accent to get this across is like an extreme level of difficulty.
I know.
Let's hear it in proper Australian. Go on. Right.
So, Shora Agdashlo, you dedicated the book to her, the OG. Did you have contact with her before writing, or did you get a chance to meet her at any part, to hear or hear her audio performance? Like, how did this inform your writing?
I would love to meet her. I've never met her. I'm a huge fan of Oscar-nominated legendary actress. If anyone, I'm mainly more familiar with her through her film and TV work. She's done a lot of voiceover work over the years, but in the international cinema space, and particularly in genre work, she's The Expanse, Star Trek, Punisher. It's a smaller role, but you know what I mean? Like, I've been a fan of hers for a really, really long time. She was nominated for an Oscar for House of Sound and Fog, and Best Supporting Actress. Like, she's just genuinely an icon who's been out there grinding in the business for decades. And I knew that she voiced the character of Roshan. I had listened, I had some access to certain clips from the game and chunks of the script that would be relevant to the story. That's the really tricky thing with writing a story like this. And part of the reason I pitched a story that happened way, way, way before the game is because I was trying to sort of avoid any issues with plot clashes or things that needed to be too reliant on Mirage, where, you want Mirage to be doing its own thing. And I wanted this story to be doing that as well. But it's also a logistical nightmare trying to, read this part of the script or read that part of the plot when the script can be pages. And it's like this team worked on this bit and there are little, clips of gameplay that you're watching and whatever. Anyway. She is Roshan first to me. And so dedicating the book to her was just a respect thing. I don't think this character gets to exist in the way that most people access it without her incredible voice performance and without her getting across the, I want to say grit, but grit, really. Like, the grit and the perseverance and the steadfastness of a character like this, of a woman who has seen a lot of shit and dealt with a lot of shit and, has existed in a place where, brilliance isn't the exception, it's the rule. The whole brotherhood is made up of exceptional people. And for her to sort of, be one of the masters within it is really significant. So for me, it was a respect thing. I have no idea she knows that the book's dedicated to her. I would doubt that she does, because she's a quite busy, famous, successful woman. I don't know if she's spending a whole lot of time reading Assassin's Creed novels about a character she voiced.
I mean, if you were listening to this and you work for the Ubisoft Transmedia department, please send a copy of the novel to Shore. I'm sure she'd love some flight reading or holiday reading, or I don't know.
There is a project I'm working on that I know she's up for. Well, like she's like one of the people that it's like a television series. It's 6 episodes, limited series, like one and done. Anyway, there's only 8 parts, and I know that she's sort of like one of the main people they're going for the key 8 parts. And so I'm like, oh fuck! Imagine if she gets it. That would be amazing. Is you just have like the loser writer skittle up to her on set and be like,
Are you
how?
going to be in full fangirl moment? I'm so happy to be
And listen, I wrote this TV series, but fuck that. Here's this
you.
book.
That would be great. I would just say you've sort of touched on this already, but when we see Roshan in the trailers, when we see her in the game, she is a force of nature. She really is, and I think that's emphasized by Shohreh's vocal performance. Again, you've kind of touched on this already, but did you take from the clips that you'd seen the vocal performances, the actors' performances, and how did they inform some of your writing?
Yeah, well, the tricky thing about Roshan in the games, obviously, is that she's a woman of few words, which is like great and mysterious and cool. But then you're writing a book with somebody and you actually need quite a lot of words to do that. And it's boring if all of that is internal monologue or internal dialogue. And so trying to find a happy medium where it felt that she, like, wasn't a chatty Cathy per se, because that's not who she is as a character. It's also not accurate for the social standing she was coming from at the time, but then also being something where you're allowing the readers to have insight and perspective into who she was to understand where she gets to. Because that's the thing with the book is the, no spoilers really for many of the plot details, but by the end of the novel, we're at the point where she's joining the Brotherhood at this time called Hidden Ones, right? So it's getting her to the point where she's joining. We don't actually see her spending time within the Creed. So what we want to understand is why she would make that choice and what they see in her to make her such a promising candidate when, it's a time where being a woman was just surviving as a woman was impossible, let alone surviving as a woman of a certain social standing. And so that was also part of the reason I introduced the element of it's very much like a team up book, really. I saw somebody tagged me in the thing on Instagram where they were like, it's the Suicide Squad of Assassin's Creed. And I was like, yeah, man, I guess. Like, shit, that's pretty accurate. I was thinking more Ronin at the Robert De Niro movie. Like, I think that was actually the exact wording I used in my original pitch for it was, I was like, Ronin, but Assassin's Creed, where, you have a central MacGuffin that needs to be MacGuffined. And you have a team of people who aren't necessarily familiar with each other, but all have to quote Liam Neeson, a very specific set of skills. And some of those people have good intentions, some of them have terrible intentions, but for whatever reason, they have to work together as a team. And so part of the story is trying to establish who can you trust within this group? What are their skill sets? How is that relevant to you? And how are you going to survive this mission? And having Roshan's character and her personality and her integrity and her strength be revealed through action rather than it be something that's revealed unprompted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, indeed. Over to you, Chris.
So, how well formed was the character of Roshan, and what kinds of discussions did you have with the writers of AC Mirage?
So they read the final manuscript of the book and provided notes and annotations, but they also looked at the expanded synopsis, like that 4,000, 5,000 word one. That was like the last sort of step before then off you go, Maria, go write the book. So they had provided feedback and notes on various aspects of that. And then I had also spoken with a friend of mine who wasn't working on Mirage, but has worked on previous Assassin's Creed games, Jeffrey Yolaheim, who so insightful because not only is he a brilliant writer, but in particular, because he'd worked across multiple Assassin's Creed properties and because he works in-house at Ubisoft and has worked on various games for them, had a really great understanding of world building mechanics with in that world, because at the end of the day, like, I know how to build a world, but I'm trying to build a world within a world specifically for Ubisoft. So there's things that do and don't make sense in the Assassin's Creed world. For instance, I think this is the only novel of mine that doesn't have a sex scene. And so I was just like, oh, wow, is that growth? Like, maybe. Because all my stuff's like, you know, I feel like every book should have like some murder, some comedy, some spooky business, and like some shagging. Like, horniness is like an essential part of life and an essential part of stories. So, you know, that's cool. All good in the hood. Ubisoft, like, maybe less of that. I was like, fair enough. I'll insert a few more murders or whatever, or like, you know, pushing my personal agenda, which is, I'm a Pacifica woman, and Assassin's Creed hasn't had very many, if any, sort of inclusion of Pacifica elements in the story. And historically, where the games are set and where the novels are set, that is something where I have been like really desperate for that. And I think it's really rich story material. So I was like, you know what? If I'm getting to be the architect of this story, we're introducing a Pacifica character, which is a Samoan warrior princess in this particular case. And, you know, making that relevant for the time period, giving her weapons that are specific to Samoan mythology, things like that. So there are certain elements of stuff that I'm bringing to the table, but then I have some sort of like landmarks that are set in terms of the Harbor Master storyline was something that already existed in her background and I believe had been mentioned previously in Assassin's Creed IP, so had to be something that was mentioned. But there was also, for instance, there's a letter that Roshan writes to somebody in Mirage. And the person that she writes that letter to is a character in the book. Now, that character, you know, you're pitching a sort of like broad story originally, but that character from the book I create based on getting to see her writing this letter to somebody all these decades later. Mm. Now, is that something that most people are going to pick up? Probably not. But it's just trying to find... Okay, great. Excellent.
The thing is, I'm putting my hand up, but of course, this is audio. So again, this is a stupid thing to do. But we were lucky to get early access to the book. So when I was exploring, I think the letter is in Alamut. And when, of course, you play as Basim, but Basim can wander around and read different letters. And I think there is a letter from Roshan to one of her friends from the olden days, shall we say.
Yeah, which again,
like, oh, that's a nice little reference. Yeah.
Well, it's also rare. It's like, that's the thing about people within the Brotherhood, is that you are not fully aware of their backstories, or like their past is meant to be left in the past, right? So this idea of friends and family and relationships is how you touch into that, and how you explore that can be pretty tenuous. But even the like mentor-mentee relationship between Roshan and Basim. Like, obviously he's too young to exist within the novel. He doesn't even exist yet, but trying to find ways to sort of echo that story and to understand why she, what she would see in him down the line and why she wouldn't want to take somebody like him on, I think is important. Like, sort of trying to stay true to the tones and themes of aspects that you've seen of Roshan as an adult, and how you're seeing that play out here in the story, which has a chapter in the past, a chapter in the present, but is basically juggling dual timelines so I can cover her from the age of basically about 14 to 24.
I think we get to this a bit in a later question, but she goes through some stuff
at
a young age, and then for a number of years. You can understand why she wants to join the Hidden Ones to try and affect society
during that time period
in a positive way.
Very few people had a good life, honestly.
Yeah, indeed. I'll ask the next question. I'll just explain to readers this question. To be fair, you've probably already answered it, but I'll just explain why. You can't just phone up an author and say, hey, can we chat about your book? You have to approach the publisher. Chris and I had to write questions in advance, and Ubisoft had to approve it, which of course we're fine with. On reflection now, having written these questions a few weeks ago, some of them are perhaps a little bit repetitive, but I'll ask it anyway because, hey, you might think of an anecdote or something extra to add. So it must have been important to give Roshan, consistent character growth between Daughter of No One, the game Assassin's Creed Mirage, and she has a short appearance in Valhalla as well as a final kind of closing story in the game Valhalla. How much collaboration and feedback took place between you and the Mirage narrative team led by Sarah Beaulieu? I would guess much of Mirage's story was complete, but am I wrong there? And did you have a chance to have any input into Roshan's character as it appeared in Mirage?
Yeah, just the way the timeline works with those games, like even, you know, talking about the project I worked on at Ubisoft for 4 years, it's like that was considered pre-development. Like the tale on the way the gaming world works is astounding to me, truly. Mm. Like, I don't understand how anybody gets anything done because they spend so much time and attention to detail and just like love and thought poured into every single aspect of the game, of every game they work on, even ones that aren't Assassin's Creed that maybe slip under people's radar. There's artists and cultural consultants and just all sorts of things, historical consultants, language consultants, before you even get to the technical aspect of building a game. So the game was locked by the time I was brought on to write the novel. Okay. So it was more about just getting access to any little pieces. I wasn't allowed to play or view the thing in its entirety, but I was given permission and access to anything that specifically pertained to Roshan. So I was able to see cutscenes, view pieces of the script, stuff like that. Little bits and bobs of some of the incredible voice performance that had already been recorded. But for the most part, just, you know, little snippets here and there, which can be tough because you're viewing them out of context, but you just have to sort of extrapolate and go from there. Obviously, as mentioned, Ubisoft, they provided me notes in the synopsis stage and in the final delivery of manuscript from Sarah and from the rest of the team. But also, there were tentpole things that couldn't change about her story. The area that she was from, the Harbor Master stuff had to stay. It was just making sure like those things can't change. So then you're filling in the gaps in between. And there would be suggestions that I would have that would, like, for instance, obviously, like having sex scenes was like a bridge too far. So you roll that back, or it's, finding out ways to have a murder or a death scene. That was actually one of the things, is that I couldn't have Roshan actively murder anybody in the story. And so that becomes really tough because
that's quite a tight restriction in a game where we spend a lot, I know it's not a game, in a franchise where we spend a lot of time stabbing people.
Yes, exact, Chris, correct. Because I was like, wait, what do you mean? Like, it's really important that, and we have said previously that when she joins the Brotherhood, the only person she has, like, you know, really intentionally murdered is this Harbor Master character that's been mentioned previously. And I was like, all right, that's really tough. So trying to find ways to not have have her be active and defensive and offensive, while also not, she's not an assassin. That's the whole point of this book, is it's like what gets her to the point of seeing that as a possible viable future. She has skills and she has talents and she has traits. So like, let's look at the time period about what they could be outside of physical prowess. She obviously is physically gifted in a certain skill set that she learns from a certain character in a certain time period that's tied to a certain geographical place, but also things like seemingly small stuff to us, like being able to read and write during that time period, were a huge superpower, especially if you're a woman. But then also being able to, do calculations, mathematical calculations, to be able to understand things like how to sail, how to orchestrate through different parts of the world via boat, to understand wind, currents, tides, all of that kind of stuff. All of those traits and skills and a part of the gameplay in Assassin's Creed, and oftentimes the things that characters can already do because they're already part of the Brotherhood. But if this is pre-Brotherhood, then let's show her trying to understand those things. Let's show her trying to learn those skill sets, and let's show her learning things from other characters that she picks up and takes with her going forward in the story, so that hypothetically speaking, if you do read this novel and you have played the game, there might be a few things about Roshan or how she moves or how she operates or a skill set that she has that you're like, oh my gosh, that's how she got XYZ thing, now I understand, blah blah blah.
Absolutely. So Daughter of No One isn't your first novel. Mockingbird Strikeout, I think, would be your first question.
Oh, with this publisher?
Oh, tie-in novel.
Tie-in novel.
Sorry,
yeah.
Yeah.
So how challenging is it to write something that's already got existing characters in an existing universe? Like, what are the positives and the negatives?
Positives are these are... Like, I'm never pitching on something that I don't care about. Like, I'm never pitching on an IP that I'm not super, A, familiar with or B, passionate about. So the positive is you're getting to play in a world that you're excited about, a world that you love, a world that you're a fan of. I'm a fan first and foremost. So that's really exciting to me. Like, I love Assassin's Creed. And so, like, just entertaining the possibility that I get to play in that world, and the world building for me is one of my favorite aspects of the story. Like, it's, I don't have necessarily a specific game or even a specific Assassin's Creed novel where I'm like, that's the one for me, because I'm just excited to be immersed in the story and see where it takes you. I love sort of, I call it alternate history, but anything that's like historical tie-in is really interesting to me, where you're starting to incorporate elements of a made up quote unquote story into parts of history that people know already or think they know. So that's the kind of thing that makes me really excited is, I've spent a lot of my time and most of my career coming up with original characters and original stories and original IP. It's really hard. It's great because you have full power and full real estate, but it is really hard to do creatively. It's also really hard to make people care about. So coming into stuff like this, it's like a cheat because people already care. And so much of the work is done for you in terms of the world and so much of the mechanics of it. So it really is like getting to play with somebody else's toys. In terms of the negatives, there really aren't that many. I guess really the only thing is you have a stakeholder. It's like you really clearly have a boss in terms of, certain things that you can or can't do. For instance, on Marvel, I wasn't allowed to swear, which I'm a quite sweary person, as I'm sure you've realized in the, 20 minutes that we've been doing this conversation. I think most Australians and Kiwis are. So for a Marvel property, it's like no swearing, and also like your characters can't kill anyone. And if there's violence, it has to be of a superheroic nature. So there's like little, I call them like no benders, like things like that, that just, can't be tweaked. Yeah. But again, this isn't my first time at the IP rodeo. Like DC Comics had stuff that was very similar on the project. I worked for them for years. And so having done that, having worked for Marvel, having worked at places like AMC and Netflix, I was familiar with what you need, like how far you can push things and the things that you have to be willing to fight for. And also if you don't want to be told no, this is not the job for you. You know what I mean? Like, you're coming into somebody else's world, and a world that people have spent in many cases decades working on. So it's a matter of being respectful as well. I know that if I had a writer coming into like Supernatural Sisters series or something that I worked on for years and have novels and, you know, expanded universe, and there's fans who've drawn artwork and made podcasts and stuff, I would appreciate the respect. So it's just about, I think, being respectful in return.
I just a sort of a tangential question just popped into my head then. The franchise has been around for 16 years this year, isn't it, since the first game. And, you know, the chances that people now creating the games, writing the books, will have played the games and had exposure and experience of the universe and the stories is just so much higher. The early novels were just written by people who'd probably not touched the games, you know, just because gaming was a smaller business in those days. But I think there's just a lot more chance now that you and others that sort of join the media side of this franchise, you're probably already fans, probably like people joining the Marvel creative teams are now. They've probably seen the films, read the comics, you know. And it's the same with Star Wars, isn't it? The number of people now who are writing and directing and producing Star Wars. My daughter and I, we went to the Star Wars Celebration in London earlier this year, and quite a few of the people on the stage were like, I loved the films when I was a kid, and now I'm here and I get to make my contribution to, you know, the Star Wars universe. And it must be very similar for you and others that are creating for this universe.
I mean, it's one of the things, actually, this is a challenge that was tricky, was, you know, on the Marvel project, for instance, you have the character of Bobby Morse has existed pop culturally for over 50 years, right? So you have 50 years worth of canon to negotiate, 50 years worth of stories, that there are some things that stick and some things that don't, in terms of stuff that has to be in her backstory. Like, she has to be married to Hawkeye, they have to get divorced, blah, blah. She has to get a spy going from there, right? But whether, you know, some versions of the story she has scroll powers, some she doesn't. It's, you know, pick or choose different aspects. And Bobby's story exists in our current timeline, in our current world, over a span of really about 30, 35 years. For a character like Roshan in a world like Assassin's Creed, there is no limit to the time period it exists within. So it's like literally from the birth of time to present day. That is the scope of it.
That is your sandbox that you
can
play in.
That is all the threads of the world exist within that. And so I remember, like, the first sort of time I was, you know, sitting down and going, and thank God Assassin's Creed has such loyal fans. But, you know, when you're just sitting down and sort of starting to pick through various timelines, it's like Assassin's Creed is so deep and detailed, and there's so much depth to it, that you pick any time period, any year, 891 or whatever, and any part of the world that exists, there's a quite detailed Assassin's Creed story happening in it that then ties in to something that happens 100, 200, 1,000 years later. So it's you've got to be very careful about where you train and making sure that you're not crushing like a little, you know, ant city that's been built beneath your feet. So that was a really fascinating thing, is, yeah, like, not only have the games and the novels been around for a while now and fans of them, but the actual story itself now spans millennia. So it's broad. It can be really broad.
I remember we interviewed one of the narrative leads, Darby McDevitt, nearly a year ago. And I remember one of the questions I asked him was, again, this is off topic, sorry, Ubisoft, this is not on the document, but I think it's a safe question. One of the questions I asked him was, I think the Assassin's Creed fan wiki has something crazy like 28,000 articles. And I said to him, is that constraining? And he said, not really, because we've still got in countries and centuries we haven't even touched yet. So, you know, it's fine. But yeah, you're right. There is so much characters and places, and for every day of the year, something is happening, you know.
It's truly nuts. And again, that's what I'm saying. Like, I really hope we get to get into more of the Pacifica history and stuff, because I do really think it's a rich. The Southern Hemisphere has been largely ignored sort of in the franchise so far. And as you're picking through so many other types of history in the Middle East and, Celtic history and things like that, there's a really, really rich story world and historical world, where there's really damaging political figures that are getting killed in mysterious ways that you could just, I don't know. I just think it's rich territory to mine.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Let me ask a question about the structure of the novel. So the novel follows two timelines and we switch between them. We start with Roshan escaping from a horrible situation. And then we have a second timeline where she's, as you say, she's doing a heist, perhaps you could say. So when did you decide to use that structure for the novel and follow those two timelines in parallel? And how does that structure help build the character and build the narrative?
Well, I think the sort of like modus operandi I had for this story was to sort of understand where she's going. You need to understand where she's been. And I feel like that way for lots of different characters and things. But the idea of the sort of like ongoing heist mechanic that is the main sort of narrative catalyst throughout the story is great. But for a character like Roshan, who's not super verbal and not super revealing in terms of things that she tells people about herself or about her past, that heist timeline happens many years after the Harbour Master stuff. And again, as mentioned, Harbour Master was a thing that had to be in there, and that happens at a very specific age. So that's not something that was bendy in any way. It was like hard concrete cement. So what's realistic about how that story would come to the reader's attention? Is she recollecting that as a memory that seems a bit like wistful and takes you a bit out of the action? Is she telling that story to someone? I don't necessarily buy that that's believable. So it was kind of the idea of the dual timeline thing was out of practicality more than anything. I've done that in a few other novels of mine, so I was familiar with the actual like technical process and what could be gained, but also how difficult that can be just to make sure that. It's always juggle with this kind of thing is making sure that the chapters in the past are as compelling as the chapters in the present. And you have to try and find a balance so that it's not weighted one way or the other. But then there's also things that are currently paying off in the story. So you begin to understand in the present timeline why she is the way she is based on stuff that's happening in the past. So it was a practical mechanic more than anything, but also. It's a great way to be able to cover a breadth of time. The heist itself only really takes place over the course of a few weeks. And I was constantly thinking about, this might be the only piece of Assassin's Creed media where we get Roshan as the main character. So hypothetically, if that is the case and we never get to see her having this much story real estate again, I wanted to try and tell as much of that story as possible. For the readers and for the people who are interested in her journey.
That's absolutely fascinating because I really did enjoy the dual timeline story. It's not something you encounter very often. And yeah, I actually really enjoyed the earlier timeline story.
Oh, good.
That was my favourite one. I like both of them, but there was something about the earlier timeline that I really enjoyed, so that's great
Well, it's
stuff.
also like game mechanics, isn't it? It's like every skill that a character has in the game, you have that in any game, but specifically Assassin's Creed, you have that learning period where you have to, oh, you've got a new skill, but then you have to learn and adapt to that skill. So it's trying to like use game mechanics, but in a narrative way in the book so that there was, you can't be like Control X or whatever the fuck in the book, right? But giving people that similar sort of feeling of that every skill she acquires or every new ability she gets feels really earned.
So Roshan goes through some early trauma. It kickstarts her journey towards the Hidden Ones. We see in the games and other books that many Hidden Ones and assassins are driven by trauma to join the group. Was that hard to write? And how important is it to get the character's motivation right? Sorry.
Honestly, that time period was pretty fucked.
Yeah.
It's like everybody, I don't know what time period it doesn't make sense to join the Brotherhood. Like, basically, I was even trying to do this like in my head one time when I should have been writing and I was procrastinating. I was like, at what point do you get up to where you're like, I'm good, actually? You know what I mean? Like, life hasn't been that traumatic, so the brotherhood doesn't make sense to me. And I was sort of like the 80s, and I was like, no, man, if you were like, deep in the trenches, if you're provos or in the troubles or something, you'd be like, there's just trauma everywhere. There's war everywhere and every timeline all the time. And so it's just never not feasible for the mechanics of how the Brotherhood was created to begin with and the purpose that they serve, the difference between free will and control and power and self-power. The actual conceit of that as a concept therefore begets this idea that you need to have some kind of difficulty or some kind of thing that you need to overcome or have been through or are still overcoming in order for you to be a candidate to join. So it was just like, this is the world. This is the sandpit they made. So if I want to play in it, I got to play in it.
Were there any passages that were particularly difficult to write?
I think language is always a big one. I come from a journalism background, so I want everything to be as accurate as possible. And setting a book in this time period is very specific. But then it's also, if you are too, I don't want to say if you're too accurate, but if you're too hindered by the time period, then the novel isn't engaging to a modern audience. So it's really tricky because you're essentially trying to tell a story that feels modern in a very specific time period. It's a bit like any sort of historical action movie or like any historical epic is you have to put aside a certain type of like language accuracy, I guess, and lean in to the things that are compelling about the story. Otherwise, it becomes a different type of book. So I guess it was what was hard for me, or like what was difficult, is just being having to let certain things like that go and make the number one priority be, is the story entertaining? Are you engaged? Is Roshan driving this forward? And does this fit within the world of Assassin's Creed that has existed for, almost 2 decades at this point?
So, Assassin's Creed is a 15-year-old franchise with a very complex history and lore at this point. Did Ubisoft team give you a briefing on key points? You already did say you were a fan. Did you have any prior? Did you have to do any of your own research, or did you aim to write something that anyone could pick up without prior knowledge to any of the games or books?
So that was my intention, was to make this book something that anybody could read. Assassin's Creed is a passion of mine, obviously, but I come with an audience who are attached to me, who perhaps maybe aren't as familiar with Assassin's Creed. Let's say 20% of my pre-existing audience are Assassin's Creed fans. Great. Okay, so that leaves 80% of them who've never engaged with an Assassin's Creed property before. So I want to make it accessible to them while also something that still feels accurate to the brand and accurate to the franchise. But it's just like anything doing that exists within the IP world. Stan Lee had this great quote that I think about all the time, where he said that every comic book is somebody's first comic book. And I think about that every time I write, because, even the Supernatural Sisters series, right? That's my own IP. But I specifically built those so that even though they were interconnected, 8 novels set within the same world, each novel could be picked up and read individually without pre-existing knowledge of the ones before, so that nobody was excluded. I'm always trying to find ways to make my storytelling inclusive rather than exclusive. So if you're an Assassin's Creed fan, I think you're going to get more from this novel, obviously, than somebody who isn't. But at the end of the day, like, my grandma read this book and she has no idea what Assassin's Creed is. But she loves a good yarn. She loves a good story. And for her, this is a story about a
She's
woman.
your grandma. She must be your biggest fan, right? That's what grandmas are there for.
I guess maybe she's actually more importantly, she's a big fan of mine, whatever, who cares? She's a big reader. Like she reads everything. And so that's really handy because I know that If she's like on something, it's like, oh shit, I need to do better, I need to improve that or whatever. And so for her being hooked in on this book and engaged in it, that's the kind of duality of accomplishment. You want it to be something that feels faithful to the world and exciting to long-term fans of Assassin's Creed, but I also love the idea of maybe this is the first time anyone's been exposed to AC, and this is, you know, this is a book that they can read without feeling like they need to do a whole bunch of homework.
Yeah, understood. I'll read the question that I wrote, and I've just got a little additional part of the question which I didn't write. How did you give Roshan, a woman of Persian origin in the 9th century, a convincing backstory? I think you've touched on that. Did you need specialist knowledge, or did you specifically research the time period to make it more grounded? And just the side question that I suddenly thought, because you had a lot of contact with the development team, the other writers, did you create kind of a Roshan mood room with her concept arts and different things whilst you were writing, or was it all virtual and in your mind?
Bless your heart that you think I got access to endless amounts of Roshan art. I don't think I saw a single piece of Roshan artwork or drawing. I saw her in clips. Okay. Is what I saw. The renderings of her, of Roshan, that I got access to were through the internet. So okay. Thank you.
A digital mood room is not quite the same thing, is it really?
No, it's not possible. But shout out to everybody who runs the Assassin's Creed wikis and fan pages, because those were the ones who put together all of the, here's all the renderings for Roshan, and people, yeah, as well as just fan art, just like incredible fan art. She's a lot younger in the novel than she is in the games, so it's like, you know, you're extrapolating from there, but sort of just having like a bit of understanding of her physicality. And I'm a quite like stout, stocky person, so I love a bit of stocky representation, is what I feel that she has. But yeah, I mean, it's, again, it is really tricky. You're trying to juggle the modern lens and the past lens, and there are certain texts that I read, certain people that I spoke to. It's a little bit different to doing things like, for instance, I have a book called Who's Afraid, which is about a werewolf who is from Scotland. And for a story like that, you think, oh, okay, werewolf, well, that's a made up creature. Like, how could you possibly research that? But I interviewed a full moon expert. I interviewed cryptozoologists. I went to Dundee, which is where the story is set. Like, you're trying to combine the mythological research with the geographical research while also creating and entrenching readers in a world that feels wholly unique and lived in. And with this, there are parts, there are places that Roshan visits in the novel that I had been to physically myself. And so it was sort of like trying to capture how those places felt, how they smelled, what was the lived-in quality of going to those cities, even though when she's visiting those cities is thousands of years before I have. So, you know, like, it's carry the one, divide by two. You know, you're really, like, taking some liberties there. But trying to find ways where the things that were really grounded in reality that I could either speak to somebody directly about that, or my own primary sourcing about places that I'd been to and things that I'd seen, a lot of academic text reading, a lot of documentary watching, and then a lot of trying to parcel out what other pieces I can use and what other pieces that I can't, because nothing worse if something gets lost in the source, in terms of you've spent an entire page Tolkiening it, right, where you're describing a hallway or whatever. It's like, this is a murder book. This is an action movie in literary form, right? So making sure that the story always feels propulsive, but that there are those moments where if there is a breather, or if there is a moment of reprieve, that is paying service to the story.
Very good. I'm going to have a look out for this book set in Dundee now.
Not Who's Afraid. Who's Afraid 2. Who's Afraid? So it's set in Scotland. So there you go.
Okay. Sounds good. Definitely looking into that one. So, Roshan spends a lot of time hiding in the House of Wisdom, actually one of my favourite parts of the book. Did you imagine that building in your mind, or did you just see some of the concept art or in-game kind of already maybe answered that? But
I could spend forever talking about the House of Wisdom because it's so fascinating. But for those who
let's fucking go.
You know, like the Library of Alexandria is kind of the sort of historical learning epicenter that people more commonly know, but House of Wisdom was just like amazing place where sometimes it's really wild to me, like how regressive, like we think we're so progressive in 2023, but it's like actually culture and society is so regressive. And the House of Wisdom, it was like women could be scholars, women could enter and learn, people from all different races and ethnicities could come and read and learn and study and discuss, and it didn't matter. It was like this sort of this cathedral of learning, and obviously there's all different historical versions and ideas of what the House of Wisdom actually was. There's even scholars who believe that it was not a real place, but you know, majority of the evidence points to it actually being a physical real place that existed. But just this idea of this essentially library existing during that time period and during all the different conflicts that start to bubble up around religion in particular, but race as well, and then gender and everything, I just thought it was incredible. And I was fascinated by that, and I just thought for a character like Roshan, who has quite literally come from nothing and come from a very specific town that still exists in a very specific place and has been intentionally kept in the dark because, you know, knowledge is power. People can control you by limiting what you have access to. What is the inverse of that? Suddenly having endless possibilities for growth, both academically, spiritually, culturally, it was just exciting to me. I love a library in a story. Like I love a mystical library. This isn't a mystical library, but just like, you know, I just think that it's such a great device. But also for somebody like her, where I think this stereotype for female characters in Assassin's Creed stories is that they're powerful through their physicality. We're giving them, you know, masculine traits, but like being able to punch somebody real good or wield a sword or bow and arrow. But I love that Roshan's first superpower is learning to read. It's learning to do calculations. It's learning about the world through text. And I wanted that to sort of be quite sharp juxtaposition to some of the other skills that she picks up as she goes. Because at the end of the day, her being able to think her way out of a problem is just as critical as her being able to smash her way out of a problem.
Yeah, definitely came across, like you said, Chris, that whole sequence, first of all, of her hiding and surviving on rats. Don't think that's too much of a spoiler.
Oh, gross.
And then, yeah, she starts to teach herself, and then she gets taught by this mysterious benefactor. Mm. It was great. It was a fantastic origin story. What do you hope people will take from your novel about Roshan? What kind of person is she?
Really good question. I think I don't want to say noble, but I really do feel like that's who she is. You know what I mean? Like, I think the version that of Roshan that people get to meet in the games is very fully formed. Like, she really, but I mean, as you would be by the time you get to your 50s and 60s and shit, you're pretty locked in to the person that you are, your breadth and capacity yeah. for growth, personal or otherwise, is pretty capped by that point. So I wanted people to see the foundations for her moral and ethical code. I wanted people to sort of understand who she is from that point of view and to understand how she gets there. You know, like there's so many aspects of the Assassin's Creed world and her time period and the places that she navigates, right, that I found so interesting. You know, we talk about the different geographical locations or historical things that she's weaves through, like the House of Wisdom, but it's also about what kind of music was she exposed to? What kind of foods did she eat? What kind of foods did she like? What were the scents, the tastes, the smells, the sounds of her life in this time, in this 10-ish year time period that we first get to meet her? And how does that shape who she is? Like, even the point in the Mirage game where she's writing a letter to somebody, I need to be able to explain how she can write for a woman of her status and a woman at that time period. It's not just a given that people in the Brotherhood are 100% completely literate, right? So weaving that into the story so that everything feels earned and everything about her feels earned is hopefully, for me, what I hope people take away, that nothing feels flippant or just like thrown in there. Everything, whether it's a plot point or a personal point, that it feels really intentional to Roshan and who that character is.
So Darush is named in the novel, and someone a young Roshan works for. I assume this is the same Darush that Passon works for a few decades later.
Yeah, it is. Nice pull. Yeah. It is the same one. That was one of the ones, like one of the sort of, you know, many characters and many tie-ins. Obviously, there's some stuff to Assassin's Creed Dynasty, which was like a manga that I was trying to, you know, tie in little plot points and character beats to, because I think that work was incredible, and I could never do what they did in terms of like just the depth and the timeline and the artistry, but just trying to sort of acknowledge, hey, I see what you're doing over there within the, you know, various Assassin's Creed tie-in media properties, and I think it's cool. But having her be in that city at that specific time was just like, well, he would be here. Logically, he would be here. He's essentially like a, you know, a master of thieves, if you will, and that has to start out somewhere. So by the time Basim gets there, he's at a different level. But to get to that level, you have to negotiate through various points. So it just made sense. By the time the story is inching a little bit closer to timelines where characters like that could overlap, it's like, why would you have just a random character that I could throw in here that you never see again, when it could be somebody that we've actually spent a little bit of time with, and actually then again strengthens the connection and the connectivity between Roshan and Basim when it happens down the line. She really understands like where he comes from and understands his story in a way that, as much as there's a lot of compassion to that relationship to begin with, there's also a lot of lived experience. You know, I think it's very easy for people to have compassion and sympathy for people whose life's experiences they either recognize or can connect to.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, she's, when Mirage opens, you know, and Basim is doing his early thieving missions, you know, Roshan is right there, and she says it's so handoffish. She says, "Pay the boy," you know, and then she sort of walks out, and he's kind of a minnow in the presence of this giant, but actually, yeah, she sees him. She knows he's at the bottom of the ladder, like she was 20, 30, 40 years before.
Yeah, and I think that's always one of the cool things about Assassin's Creed as a franchise, is that, you know, the smallest, seemingly smallest person can impact history or impact or create change, positive or negative. It can echo through time in a very specific way. So I sort of always really liked that about the games broadly, but also trying to find ways to weave that ideology into the story, where it's like, there are no little things, actually. Like, nothing is insignificant. Everything is loaded with story potential and meaning.
Understood. Yeah. That's the end of our questions. I've just got one final question here, which is any final thoughts, any final messages you want to share to people listening?
No, I mean, like, honestly, thanks to you guys for, number one, reading the book, but also, number two, being so engaged with it and coming up with such great questions and being so thoughtful in the things that you asked. And picking up all the little pieces that are put in there. Like half the time you're putting in stuff to amuse you and amuse, the other Ubisoft people who are as in depth and in the weeds as you are. So when other people pick that stuff up, it's really special. But yeah, any last thoughts? Nah, just like if people like the book, thank you. If people pick it up and read it, awesome. That's great. There is an audiobook version out as well, which I didn't know about until a few days ago, and they sent me a clip, and I was like, wow, this sounds amazing. So that made me really excited. So if maybe textual reading is a bit of a slog, there is an audio version as well that I recommend, and the narration is just incredible.
That's great news. That's great. Yeah, it's always good to have the audio version as well. All right. Well, that's the end of our chat about Daughter of No One. Chris, anything else you want to add?
I think if you're an Assassin's Creed fan, you will enjoy this book, no doubt. That's
Yeah,
that.
it's steeped with Creed stuff. We do like books with Creed stuff in.
Very creedy.
Oh, I've just remembered something. I'm going to ask it. Our assassins, they have a special ability, some more so than others. What's that like to write that and make it, like you said, you wanted to write the book for people that understand the franchise, but you also wanted to write the book for people that are new to the franchise. So how do you write the eagle vision, the sixth sense, in a way that's clear, engaging, a bit mysterious, all the rest of it? Is that hard to do, or is it quite easy?
Oh my God, that is so hard, actually. That was one of the hardest parts to write because it's such a like, how do you describe it? Like, it's hard to describe without doing it. Like, the thing that makes Eagle Vision cool, and like the thing that makes it specific and identifiable to Assassin's Creed fans is their physical involvement in it. You know what I mean? Like, they are like, they're part of it, right? They have an element of control to their experience. So taking that away, you're just describing something almost in a passive fashion. So I don't want it to be something that's I didn't want to like have it described the way it is in the game. Like I was just like watching it happen in the game, and that's what I'm describing. That's also pretty fucking boring. But the way different people experience it is very like unique. So with Roshan, it was all about light and color. That's essentially how I had her experience it, and that's how I was describing it. Is for her, she it's basically like a glow, like a fortuitous glow that's sort of helping direct her through various events and various life points that she doesn't necessarily identify as being something that other people can share and experience as well, essentially up until she meets the Brotherhood, obviously. But it is something that for her has always been special and unique. And I think every ethnic family has that, like you always, well, at least maybe in my family, it's like you have that auntie who always gets like a specific feeling at a specific place. You have the spooky uncle who, can talk to spirits or whatever. And there's all different versions of that, especially in Indigenous cultures. And sort of trying to have Eagle Vision be something that was present and ever present throughout her life and throughout the lives of people who knew her family in particular, but it be described as something else, because like how would you have the perspective or knowledge of what that is without exposure to the Hidden Ones and the Brotherhood? So sort of trying to make it feel realistic within her worldview and her knowledge base, up until the point that she meets them.
Very good. All right. Thank you very much. Well, that is the end of the recording. Maria, thank you so much for joining us. And what is it, 9 o'clock in the morning on the other side of the
Nine
world?
seventeen AM.
Oof, I really appreciate you being up early and ready to chat, because time zones can be tricky
I appreciate you
sometimes.
guys being
So,
up late, and appreciate you guys putting up with my tonsillitis
oh
and
no,
pharyngitis.
no problem at all. Glad you're
Can't
back.
wait
Glad
for
you're
that tonsil
well.
surgery, let me tell you. Cannot wait till they Assassin's Creed my throat and take these tonsils out.
Yeah, I don't, if the surgeon walked in and flicked his wrist, and then that would not be a good time in the theater, I
I
think.
honestly, Hidden Blade, I don't care. Just get him out at this point. Anyway, thanks so much for having me.
That's
I
been
really
great.
appreciate it.
Appreciate it. So thank you, Maria. Thanks, Chris, for joining me again. Thank you all for listening, and we'll be back very soon.